it's time to head out on the road and grab a slice of Americana. It's the Nocturnal Journey on 720 WGN. Mandarino, Chicago, Fargo, Minnesota,
Buffalo, Toronto, Winslow, Sarasota, Wichita, Tulsa. Welcome back to Nocturnal Journal and our little Nocturnal Journey segment. We're going to go down to New Orleans and talk to Liz Williams. I first met Liz Williams in the summer of 2006 when she was planning a permanent location for her Southern Food and Beverage Museum, they call it SOFAB, in New Orleans. Liz founded the nonprofit museum in 2003 in the wake of Hurricane Katrina, when identity was a major issue in the Crescent City. People always talk about food as comfort, Liz told me then, and food is definitely comfort and identity. If all that is taken away from you, especially in a city like New Orleans, that defines itself by its food, you've taken away somebody's culture. She finally opened SOFAB on September 29, 2014 at 1609 O.C. Haley Boulevard, within walking distance of the Central Business District. SOFAB is a compelling and whimsical space, a 30,000-square-foot museum without walls. Walking through the museum is like strolling through the aisles of a grocery store. Partnering up with the Museum of the American Cocktail, SOFAB has exhibits, a gallery space, a pantry with handmade artisanal gifts, and a fantastic selection of food books and magazines. The Menu Project is an ongoing exhibit and an effort to curate menus from restaurants throughout the South. You can even carry food around the museum. Chef Ryan Hughes operates Purlieu, a full-service restaurant and bar adjacent to the museum. I researched my Soul Food and Civil Rights book in the SOFAB Culinary Library, consisting of more than 11,000 cookbooks, documents, and archival material. We did this interview back in October when we launched our book tour there, and I talked to Liz this week. She's working now on an apron exhibit that reflects the role of women and linens in the kitchen and dining room. So here she is, Liz Williams from New Orleans.
What do you do here? Tell us about the museum and what people can see, and cooking demonstrations, book signings. Tell us the whole what you do here.
So I'm the director of the museum, and also the founder. So we can kind of make it up as we go along, because there aren't a lot of food museums.
Right.
And so one of the things that we knew from our previous incarnation at the Riverwalk was that we wanted a demonstration kitchen. So here in this location, we have a terrific demonstration kitchen that is very well equipped. And that's a very user-friendly space and very versatile. You can have chairs and set it up like an auditorium, or you can set it up like a classroom or whatever, with monitors over the cooking surface so you can see inside of the pots and watch people chop and all of that sort of thing. Then we have our exhibit space, where we have all the states of the South represented. And we have the Museum of the American Cocktail. We have a whole section about absinthe. And then we also have a changing gallery. And right now our exhibit is Nathan Myhrvold's Modernist Cuisine Photography, which is a really exciting photography exhibit.
And how long will that be up?
That's going to be up till the end of February.
And tell us who he was.
So Nathan Myhrvold was one of the founders of Microsoft with Bill Gates. He was actually the chief technology officer, and he became very interested in food. He's a scientist, and he became interested in food and food science, and he began to photograph it. And then he became interested in the patterns he was getting. So originally he would cut everything in half while it was cooking and then take a very fast photograph of it. And before everything fell out of the pot or whatever. Then he started to develop an interest in the patterns. So we had microscopic pictures of things like vitamin C and what the crystals looked like and whatever. And then he started to just become interested in things like fish scales and other kinds of patterns. So you can see all of those different ways that he evolved in his interest in photographing food in this exhibit. And so before it was here, it was at the Boston Museum of Science, and I don't know where it's going to go after we let it go. But we also have the launch of the book, The People's Place.
You weren't even prompted on that. That's good.
And we have other book signings and that sort of thing here, but we're really excited because I know you did some of your research at our library, and that just gives us a real connection to the book, and so that's very exciting.
Paul Natkins' photos.
And then we have Paul Natkins' photos from the book also on exhibit in our kitchen, which is just a really wonderful place because everyone sees them as they sit for our demonstrations and other kinds of things. So it's a really good place to have them.
Well, thank you for that. Thank you for that. It's just, I spent like an hour and a half in here yesterday. It's just a very welcoming place. It's a warm place. It's interesting. It's almost whimsical. I mean, some of the stuff you do. I took some pictures and put them on Facebook. But the Katrina thing with the bush bologna sandwich. Tell us how you put that together and how you designed that and why'd you go state by state and.
Well, of course, when you're trying to organize, there's so many ways that you can do it, and. We thought at one time about doing pan-Southern things, like all the corn or all the barbecue or whatever. And we realized that we would never be able to do that. And you can put your arms around, there are this many states, and so let's do that, because then you have something finite to deal with. So we have a trail of smoke and fire through the museum, so that you can go state by state and see what barbecue is in that state, but we don't actually have a separate barbecue exhibit. You get your fill of barbecue. Uh-huh.
That's very interesting.
We're working on now a trail, a soda trail, so that you can see soda pop all around the South as it's changed, and old bottles and things that are no longer made, as well as the new things. And we're going to develop trails like that all through the museum so that things that you'll find in every state, you can say, oh, I'm interested in this particular thing. And then you can see how that works.
You're not for profit?
Yes, we are.
Do you, how are decisions made? I mean, do you have a board?
We have a board.
I think about this. I mean, everybody's so passionate about food. So how do you decide, like, I saw the Google clusters and stuff. Did somebody go, oh, Google clusters? And, you know, I mean, are there different opinions on what to go in and what to go out? And
how
do you decide that? Or do you have the final say?
Usually we curate those things. The board doesn't really decide that. But, you know, it's a combination of several factors. What we can get our hands on, because we are not a place where we're going to have statues of asparagus or something like that. You know, it has to actually be something that represents the food culture of the place. And we're very interested in the food culture and not just the food stuff itself. So, yes, corn is important, but we're not going to only explore the ear of corn. We're going to talk about pellagra, and we're going to talk about grits, and we're going to talk about all the things that have to do with corn and why corn was so important, that there are all these effigies of corn everywhere, and you can buy plates that look like corn and all of that. So if you're going to explore it, you explore the whole thing and not just the food.
I mean, this is kind of what I do in my books. I mean, and you and I have talked about this before, about food as comfort and identity. I mean, can you talk about that, especially identity? Because that's kind of what I do, and that identity and sense of place and stuff, you know.
Well, there's no question that food represents your identity. I mean, one of the things that anthropologists and sociologists have observed about immigrants is they may try to assimilate in terms of work and language and even dress in a new place. But the thing that they hold on to is food. And their food is what reminds them and what they pass on to the next generation, because it's something done at home and it doesn't necessarily relate to your interaction with other people. And it's a way for you to keep your identity and still assimilate into the new culture that you're in. We all have an identity that is based on what we eat.
How do you define the South? The reason I asked that question is I was told yesterday by your people that you're maybe looking into Missouri.
Oh, yes.
Yeah, and you know, when I was researching some stuff, your chef, I was going to ask him. You know, I travel around a lot, and when I go to Cincinnati, he's got some background in Cincinnati, uh-huh. And Cincinnati is the one place I don't know where I'm at. I don't know if I'm in the Midwest. I don't know if I'm in the South. I don't know if I'm in the Upper South. I mean, I know Memphis is the Mid-South, but so how do you define the South, and how would this museum continue to grow? I mean, would you do Missouri? Would you do...
Well, yeah. We have a lot of things that are related as an answer to that question. So we chose the definition of the South that was the post-World War II definition of the New South. So that was based on railroad lines and lines of transportation and highways and different kinds of settling patterns and all of that kind of stuff. So that's why Oklahoma is in it and all that sort of thing. So the part about Missouri, of course, is its own conundrum, as it has been for a long time historically. But we actually received a packet of petitions that said, we have been to SOFAB, and we have seen what you have, and we belong there. And so because of that, we've really started to think about Missouri. Now, in this definition of the New South, Missouri is in the Midwest. And so we put stuff on Facebook about it. Does Missouri belong here and whatever? We have gotten, that has been the most commented upon post on Facebook that we have ever had. And the northern part of Missouri says we're Midwestern. And the southern part of Missouri says we're Southern. So you have that same problem with Texas. Texas, on the east side of Texas, is very Southern. And as you move west, you get more southwestern. But we would never cut a state in half.
Yeah.
So we started to think about Missouri and said, well, if we had enough interest and it seems like it belongs here, and we started to now explore that possibility, and we would love to get feedback and how people think about where Missouri belongs. But we are actually exploring a space in California to be the Pacific Food and Beverage Museum.
Oh, really?
And so our idea is to have regional museums, regional food museums around the country. We are sort of megalomaniacs here, and we've started to consider ourselves sort of like the Smithsonian of food, because we have this library, which now has over 17,000 volumes. We have a wonderful register that's called the Culinary Heritage Register, where people can, businesses or locations that are 50 years old or older can register. It could be a grocery store, or it could be a manufacturing facility or a distillery or a restaurant or any of those things that has been around in the food world or drink world for 50 years or older. And we're trying to map the entire country so that we have a great catalog of who has been pushing the cuisine of America.
That was one of my questions. There is an effort, I think it opened, that's very small,
food museum
in
mm-hmm.
Chicago. I haven't been there.
Yes.
Yeah, I haven't been there, you know. But my question was going to be, what advice would you have for somebody starting something? Have they networked with you?
They've come down. And
they have?
They were
okay.
Actually here for our opening. And
so you know, okay.
Yes.
So.
We've talked extensively, and they're trying to do something called the Museum of Food and Drink. They call it MOFAD in New York. So that's Dave Arnold and Peter Lamb, and they're trying to do something up there. They're also working on trying to do a pop-up like the one the Foodzeum is doing, a pop-up. And that's what we did when we started. We did pop-ups basically to let people know what is a food museum, because nobody knows. Everyone knows what an art museum is. Even if you never go to them, you know what it is. But when somebody says food museum, it doesn't really mean a whole lot to you. Because you've never been to one.
Yeah.
And so so having the pop-ups kind of gives people an idea about what it is you're trying to do. And, you know, I hope that they're incredibly successful.
We'll be back with more Nocturnal Journey and Liz Williams after this.
Goodbye, Joe. Me gotta go. Me oh my. Me gotta go.
Welcome back to the Nocturnal Journey segment of Nocturnal Journal. And Fats, everybody's talking about everybody dying, but Fats Domino's still kicking at age 88. That's Fats Domino's version. So we're on with Liz Williams of the Southern Food and Beverage Museum. It's a great museum if you're going to New Orleans for Jazz Fest or you're going down there. It's very interactive. It's very accessible. And that's what we're going to talk about now.
I really want to describe to the listeners about, I mean, you come in here, there's not a lot of stuff under glass. It's an open space. It's just, it's really just, I had a blast when I walked through the door.
Well, we have the belief that food is an intimate experience because you put this into your body. And so whether it's conscious or unconscious, if you come to look at things about food, you expect that intimacy.
Right.
And so if it's behind glass, it's not intimate. And most things like cast iron pots and bottles and things like that are not going to be harmed by you touching them.
Yeah.
And not everybody touches, but if someone does, it's not likely that it will be hurt. So the only thing that we put behind glass or plexiglass or something like that would be something very fragile, very tiny, or very rare, just because those things need to be protected. But if you notice the wall that is the Museum of the American Cocktail Collection, we have eye buoys that are connected by chains so that you can stand and be like at a bar, look at cocktail napkins and whatever under your elbows and whatever, but you actually can't reach anything that is on that wall.
Yeah, right.
So you don't, but you don't feel that you have a barrier. You just feel like you're behind a bar. And so we tried really hard to do that wherever we possibly could so that you feel that you have that connection to the thing. And we also let people eat and drink inside of the museum. You know, if you come in with a snowball that you got down the street, you can come in with it. And we have trash cans actually in the exhibition space so that you can throw your snowball away when you're finished with the cup. And so, you know, and we encourage people to go into the bar, which is the one of the oldest bars in the city.
I didn't know that.
And get a drink and walk around the museum with it. And so we try to make it interactive, not because it's a computer interaction, but simply because you're actually eating and drinking. And, of course, if we're having an exhibit and you have tastings or whatever, it's very interactive.
Yeah, that's great.
Yeah.
So 1 year, what's the attendance been? I mean, tell me how
doubled,
the first year went.
We've doubled our attendance from when we were at the Riverwalk, which is very exciting.
From numbers,
35,000 to about 75,000. It's a big jump for us. So now our new goal is 100,000. And we've had great press.
I saw you in an airline magazine. I think I emailed you. I forgot who.
We have just been everywhere.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it's just been really gratifying that people have been very, very interested. And they often come with the article. You know, I'm coming here because I want this or I want to see this thing. And that's been just great. We've been in the newspapers and magazines and on NPR and local TV and just all over the place. It's just been great.
Tell me what this means. The cab driver just this morning told me that we were talking about the neighborhood. I was walking around here yesterday. He said Katrina money went into this neighborhood. What does that mean? What's he talking about?
Well, not just this neighborhood,
but
in many neighborhoods that were badly damaged by Hurricane Katrina, whether it was FEMA money or insurance money or whatever, was used to sort of upgrade the neighborhood, repair buildings, all of that sort of thing.
And I don't want to forget the restaurant. Tell us about the restaurant next time.
So the restaurant is called Purlieu, and that is a Lowcountry South Carolina dish that's rice and peas. And so we called it that because, first of all, Chef Ryan Hughes went to school in South Carolina, chef school in South Carolina. But also, we wanted to let everyone know that it wasn't a New Orleans restaurant, and it really serves Southern food. And so you can get things like pimento cheese, and you can get curried goat, you can get things that you wouldn't normally get at a New Orleans restaurant, which is great.
So we've done most of this interview without me plugging my book or anything, but I will bring this up. I think it's in the chapter of my book on mothers, and I know this has been written about thousands of times, about how the taste changed here in New Orleans after Katrina. I was just talking to somebody, it has nothing to do with my book, but somebody talking about this, all the Vietnamese restaurants now and stuff. And can you just, so from an expert's point of view, can you talk about how the palate has changed here post-Katrina?
Well, you know, I would say that before Hurricane Katrina, so we're talking pre 2005,
right.
We were becoming a lot more homogenized, American homogenization. And so we were subject to all of those fast food places that everyone else is because they advertise on television and all of that. So po' boy shops were giving way to Subway or Quiznos or places like that. And Starbucks was actually trying to find a foothold here instead of having places where you're going to be drinking cafe au lait and coffee and chicory or whatever. And so that was a scary idea. But then when Katrina happened and people started to come back, the demographics of all of those fast food restaurants changed, so that because not enough people came back right at the beginning, the fast food companies didn't rebuild right away, because, you know, they say there has to be X number of people within so many blocks of this restaurant. And because of the slowness of coming back and the time it takes to repair your house and all that kind of stuff, it was a long time before that happened, but people still needed to eat. And so those mom-and-pop places, which could make a decision to open, opened right away. And since you needed a place to eat when you were working on your kitchen, even if you weren't staying in your house because it wasn't fixed enough for you to stay in, and you're mucking out dead sheetrock and all this kind of stuff, you still had to eat. So, and you weren't eating in your kitchen, you were going someplace to eat. So all these places got a little shot in the arm, and they got well established before the fast food places began to re-look at New Orleans. So once again, you got all these little places. The Vietnamese restaurants, of course, there were some Vietnamese restaurants before 2005, but they just took off because it was an opportunity. And so locals just filled the void that was left by all these fast food places that were gone. And it just meant that our food sort of took foothold again. The other thing is, going back to that question of identity, so many people, it was like a diaspora because you couldn't be in the city. And people were in Seattle and people were in Memphis. They were all over the place. And you weren't able to get your red beans or your filet for your gumbo or something like that. People came back and they said, we can't lose this. All these things we've been taking for granted are not really well established every place in this country. So we need to hold on to our uniqueness. And so people wanted to go to local places, and they wanted that local flavor. They didn't want the sort of nationalized kind of vanilla flavor, that it doesn't matter where you ate it, it tasted the same. And so that was another element of saying, let's hold on to this identity. We had almost forgotten and taken it for granted. But this forced people to sort of have their eyes open, that you couldn't take it for granted.
I've asked you this before. Where are you from originally?
New Orleans.
What part of town?
I grew up in Lakeview.
What are your earliest food memories?
Well, of course, I'm half Sicilian on my mother's side, and so there was a huge migration of Sicilians to New Orleans between about 1885 and 1915, and my grandparents came during that period. There was a huge Sicilian community, so I kind of grew up with one foot in this Sicilian community and one foot in the New Orleans community. So earliest food memories are, you know, one really early one is in my grandfather's backyard, shucking oysters, and eating them raw as he's shucking oysters, but then having them put on pasta for a meal later. So, you know, it just all meshes up together.